We're back to the Total Tutor Show, powered by the Insightful Players series. You can go to insightfulplayer.com or also simplyg.com for the Simply G Media Network. And I'm always excited about Insightful Players because, again, Chrissy Carew does such a fantastic job teaming up with the NFL to find the greatest NFL players that are helping in the community and have just awesome stories. You can go to insightfulplayer.com and read the book and also learn about the stories of each of the players that are part of Insightful Player and much, much more. So I first want to welcome to the program my co-host, Jared. Jared, how are you? And I know you're excited about our guest today.
I am, absolutely. I remember our guest, that just terrific career, and being able to watch him in the old New England Patriot uniform.
Oh yeah, that I love that old uniform, and we can talk about that in our time. But we have to be closet Patriots fans, especially for our flagship station in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. We're gonna get a lot of heat for that, Jared, for sure. But I want to welcome the program, the third time leading passer for the New England Patriots, all-star, and much, much more, great and insightful player, Steve Grogan. Steve, how are you?
I'm very good, thank you.
Absolutely, Steve. And again, it's a situation where you look at your career, but starting out, did you ever think that you were going to have that, be an NFL player and have such a career that you had?
I think I was like any other kid to dream of becoming a professional athlete. I actually enjoyed basketball in high school more than I did football, but I was better at football. I had a chance to go to Kansas State, and we weren't very good during that time period, so I wasn't real sure whether I'd get a chance at the NFL, and then the Patriots drafted me, and they already had three veteran quarterbacks, and I was told they were only keeping two, and, you know, things in life sometimes work out if you're prepared. And we had one of the veterans retired, and Jim Plunkett, who was a starter, got hurt, and I was the only guy left to stay there as the backup. And it took them 16 years until they finally figured out they made a mistake.
So that we really, Jared, go way into the story very quickly about Steve and how he got that opportunity. And I know, Jared, you have some interesting questions, especially about his childhood and stuff, right?
Well, I do. Growing up in Kansas, and you know, one of the questions I was going to ask is, but Steve answered it already, was growing up in Kansas, how do you turn to football when basketball is the number one sport in the state of Kansas? He answered that for us. But Steve, what was it like growing up in Kansas with your parents? How involved were your mom and dad in your athletic endeavors and school endeavors? And, you know, what was that like for you?
It was a great time for me. I grew up in a small town, Ottawa, Kansas, had about 10,000 people, so you knew a lot of the people in town. We were about an hour southwest of Kansas City. You know, we could hunt and fish all year. We could play our sports. There was a group of guys in my class that all loved sports and athletics and were good at it, and that made it even more enjoyable. We had a lot of success my senior year because of the group of athletes we had. My parents were very supportive. They're very involved in the community there in Ottawa, and my dad was a junior high school coach and later went on to do some coaching at the Ottawa University, small NAIA school there in town. So I grew up around sports and coaches just loved the way things went in my youth. It was a great place to grow up.
Well, absolutely. Kansas is definitely a great place to grow up, and that's one of our flagship affiliates out there in Kansas City. And I always enjoyed traveling to Kansas as a professional wrestler, Steve. I wrestled in Wichita a lot, so I definitely traveled all the way through there. Drove all the way from Pittsburgh to do the minor league circuit in Wichita and do TV on Friday nights. So
wow.
that's just a little segue back to Kansas.
You've been through the Flint Hills then, going down into Wichita. It's A lot of people think it's a boring drive, but to me, it's beautiful. You can see forever.
Well, it is. It's gorgeous, and I really enjoyed Kansas, and I was wanting to start a wrestling promotion in there. I never had it, and a good friend of mine, Derek Stone, who's on radio somewhere else now, and we were both wrestlers. We had a dream of having a territory in Kansas, and we have good friends in Kansas City and also Omaha, Nebraska, so we understand our definite Midwest roots in that certain aspect. And do you think that ultimately growing up in an area like that kept you grounded going into to play college football and then also go on to the NFL, that those roots helped you in a lot of ways to stay grounded and keep persevering?
Yeah, I'm sure they did. I think probably staying grounded came more from my family than it would have from the community. I mean, there's guys in Kansas that grow up and go on to professional sports and make a lot of mistakes and are not well grounded, but I had great family support. I knew how to conduct myself. As I said, we weren't very good at Kansas State, so I learned about getting knocked on your rear end and getting back up and believing in yourself and continuing to compete. And I think all those things helped me once I got to the NFL and the New England Patriots.
Wow.
And Neil, you led us right into kind of the question that I was thinking of here. Neil brought up his professional wrestling. Maybe not so many role models that we want to have in the wrestling field. Sorry about that, Neil. But Steve, you were absolutely one of my role models growing up here in Pittsburgh, and I remember watching you play on Sundays, and I had your jersey, and you were one of my players that I was out there throwing the football, pretending to be. How important is it do you feel that it is to be a role model? It sounds like your parents were your role model for you, and you talked about staying grounded. How important is it to be that model for young people?
Oh, I think it's extremely important. And, you know, you mentioned growing up in Pittsburgh. When I was in high school and college, Terry Bradshaw was having his great career in Pittsburgh. And I kind of admired the way he played quarterback. He was a tough guy. Didn't back down from anybody, and then when I finally get to play against him, it was a thrill of a lifetime. But, you know, when I'm out in the community talking to people about role models, people are extremely concerned about professional athletes not being good role models, and there are some of them like that. But I try to tell them that, you know, 90% of the guys in professional sport are good people doing good things in the community. You just don't hear about it. And then may not be role models, so to speak, parents, teachers, police in the community, but what kids see on a daily basis, the people they're around on a daily basis, influence their behavior far more than anybody, whether it's an athlete or a movie star or a singer. They're influenced by their community and the people they come into contact with daily far more than these guys and gals they see on television. So it's important for everybody to be a good role model.
Exactly. And as parents, we see this, Jared, all the time. We talk to parents about it, that we have to be a model for them. And the way we act in front of our children is shaping them in so many ways. And kind of going back to your family again, Steve, what would you say? How do they really shape you in the best way, especially modeling the correct behaviors at home to help you in that process of growing up to be a very successful adult and that formation? Tell us a little about that.
Well, I think it's just the way they conducted themselves. As I said, they were very active in the community, whether it was being on the board at the hospital or doing something for the college there in town, raising money for them. My dad was very involved in Kiwanis Club. I was fortunate to have a stay-at-home mom when I was growing up. I think that was extremely important to be able to leave the house with mom there and come home with mom there. Most kids don't get that opportunity nowadays, but just the way they, and not only them, but my aunts and uncles and grandparents, they all just did the right thing, and that influenced me tremendously to do the same thing.
Absolutely. And Jared, and that's what we talk about all the time on our show, don't we?
You're correct. And so many of the players, all of the players, and Steve is our latest interview to really nail the details of, you know, almost the guiding principles that that we have or that we're hoping to have. And, Neil, this is something that we started our show years ago, discussing this with parents. And, Steve, you talked about your playing career at Kansas State, and the team was not as successful as the Kansas State team these days. And certainly the Patriots had some terrific years with you, but they weren't all terrific years. How important was it? I mean, we look at athletes and we tend to only see the success. How important was it to you to have both the set success and face the challenges of being a professional athlete?
Well, there were some challenging times in my career. Went from starter to backup to starter to backup again, and then to starter again, and then had some injuries and had to go back to backing up. So, there were times when people thought I was the best thing in the world. There were times people wished I was out of town. But back in my day, they didn't have free agency, so you had to play with the team that had your contract. And the Patriots kept me around, I think, because I did whatever I could to help the team win. If I was a backup, I tried to give the defense the best picture I could give them in practice to get them prepared. And I prepared myself to be ready to play in case I had to go in the game. And that opportunity came several times, and I was able to be successful when I did it. I didn't go stomp off in the corner and cry about it and ask to be traded. I did what they asked me to do.
Absolutely. And it's something that, again, goes back to your family background and teaching you to persevere through those times and understand that those things are going to happen. One of the things you talked about, especially that I've read in your bio, is talk about the importance of education. So when you were at Kansas State, you were definitely a student athlete, weren't you, Steve? That education was an important part of your life, wasn't it?
Oh, it was. My dad being a school teacher, and a lot of the family members were school teachers also. I knew that education was important, and I knew that athletics wouldn't last forever. And if you have an education, you've got a chance when the athletics are done. Again, that was a great example set by my folks. I was not fortunate enough. I made myself graduate in 4 years. I was honored to be an All Big Eight Conference academic athlete for my junior and senior years. I just knew that studying and education was probably more important than playing football.
That's important, and then that keeps you going in a lot of ways to understanding being a student of the game to learn about football. So when we get back, we're going to go more Steve Grogan, insightful player, New England Patriot, and learn about, I guess, his whole career in New England and then life after football because, again, ultimately, especially at the time Steve played, the money wasn't there, so there really had to be a game plan afterwards. And we talked to a lot of Pittsburgh Steelers about this on our show, Washington Redskins, a lot of people that, again, life after football is a key component. And hopefully the players today learn from players like Steve. You're listening to the Total Tutor Show, powered by the Insightful Players series, insightfulplayer.com, and also the Simply G Media Network. And we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Total Tutor Show, powered by the Insightful Players series. You can go to insightfulplayer.com for more information on Chrissy Carew and purchase the book and learn about, again, the assemblies that they offer with these fantastic NFL players. And as Jared has we've talked about, and we all every week get to see, Jared, these unbelievable, insightful players. It's just awesome, isn't it?
Absolutely. And we highlighted Steve's early life and his career, and now we're going to transition to what life looks like for an insightful player after the playing days have gone by.
Close, but I am, again, as a huge fan as well, Steve, and I remember the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde type of a situation in your career, and people would talk about which Steve Grogan would show up at times. So during your career, it wasn't always a bed of roses in your 16-year NFL career, and kind of describe it for our listeners out there that might have not seen you play, that at times you were just amazing, and at other times things just didn't go as well as you hoped. Am I correct?
That's extremely correct. Like I said, I came in here with a bunch of veteran quarterbacks, not expecting to make the team. And then when I did, I got a chance to play in New York down at Shea Stadium and against Joe Namath, which was a thrill to be on the same field with him. And I threw a touchdown pass in the fourth quarter because the young quarterback veteran that was playing wasn't playing very well. I threw a touchdown pass to Russ Francis, our great tight end, and the next day they activated Plunkett off the injured reserve and cut Neil Graff, and suddenly I was backing up Jim Plunkett. 2 weeks later, he got hurt. So halfway through my rookie year, I'm the starter. And I had some ability to run the football early in my career, and probably wasn't the best passer in the world, definitely not the best passer in the world. And my running ability my first 3 or 4 years bought me time to learn the passing game so that when I started having some knee problems in my fifth and sixth year, I was ready to transition my game to stay in the game as a pocket passer.
Interesting. And Jarrett, again, you are a fan of his, so it's kind of funny. Both of us were really good fans of his growing up in Pittsburgh. What did you admire about his game, Jarrett, that really impressed you?
You know, even as a youngster, I saw the dedication, and that's actually what I admired most about Steve and his career. And as I got older, he discussed the transition where, you know, he was the he became the teacher, the mentor. And I remember, you know, seeing him with Tony Eason and you know, and on the sidelines and giving advice, being the teacher, being the coach of that, you know, another coach. And I admired that even when I got older and saw that. And, you know, Steve has highlighted what his background has done for them. You know, he didn't walk off the field and he didn't go into the corner. He was there for his team and his teammates. And I think, you know, my question for Steve is, as your career went on and you saw that the transition in from football to everyday life was going to take place, what skills kind of helped you make that transition?
You know, I was fortunate enough to play 16 years. Most guys don't get that kind of time. And I knew that by the time I got done at 37 years old, the transition into the business world was going to be more difficult than if I was younger and hadn't played as long. But I loved playing football, and I was going to make it last as long as I could. So I guess when I got done, we talked about the education earlier. I mean, you learn leadership and working with different people playing the game of football, but I didn't know a lot about business. I wasn't sure. There was no family business to go back to. So I started looking around at what I wanted to do, what I could do, what I had an ability to do, and I was smart enough to know that I had a lot of friends that were a lot smarter than me about business, and I started talking to some of them and getting their advice, and I wound up purchasing a sporting good business that had been here in Mansfield, Massachusetts for about 20 years and was on the market and having some troubles, and I bought it, and it's been 19 years, and we're still going strong.
That's fantastic, and that's, you're taking a chance too, right, Steve? Again, your career's, you had a successful career, but then to purchase a business that you don't know if it's, you're going to be able to revive it. So that's a challenge in itself.
That was a challenge, and I didn't, as I said, I didn't know a great deal about business. I knew a lot about sports, and so this kept me around sports. I had a lot of good people that had been here working for a long time that stayed and helped with the transition, and most of them are still here. So, you know, I might not have known a lot about business, but I knew a lot about people, and I could tell the people I needed to have around me and the people I didn't, and it's worked out.
And Jarrett, we hear about this all the time, right? That, again, the transition of the players in the 70s and 80s already having an idea of where they're going to go in their career and taking that skill set, Jarrett, onto the football field, from the football field to the whatever career they decide afterwards.
Right, the boardroom, the schoolroom, the classroom. Yeah, but here's what I take, and I hope our listeners are picking up on this too. Steve transitions from being the leader and the teammate in the life of football and going into the business world. I love what he said. Most of the people were still with us from the beginning. That says a lot. 16 years. There's not exactly loyalty. You know, that shows loyalty. And what I hear from Steve is, as a businessman, he's a good leader. and an excellent teammate. Steve, would you say that that's probably you have a great deal of humility with you, so you may not necessarily agree with that. But how important is it as an insightful player, a business person, to be both the leader and be a great teammate?
Oh, it's extremely important, and again, it all goes back to the role model thing. If I'm working hard and doing the right things every day, then the people around me are going to see that example that I'm setting, and hopefully we'll do the same thing.
Absolutely. And you said it perfectly in that way. And through the business world, who taught you? Who were your role models in business? We talk about, you know, how you grew up, and played for the Patriots, and you got to learn a little bit from Jim Plunkett, and you learned from all these different quarterbacks and great people that you admired in your career in the NFL. You have to have those role models in business as well. How did you learn the business game, you know, jumping in after pretty much your whole life was football before that?
Well, again, I had some friends that I had developed over the years and met that were very successful business people, and we sat down, and when I decided I was thinking about buying the business, we sat down and discussed what the opportunities were, what the disadvantages were, and I took those people's advice and put in some of what my own thoughts were and jumped in feet first and tried to make it work.
That's fantastic, and that's the key thing is, did you, Jarrett, looking and surrounding yourself with the right people. One of our good friends, or my good friend and mentor, G.J. Reynolds, said that all the time. We've got to surround ourselves with the right people in business and in life, and it's who we loaf with, who we learn from, and who we decide to hang out with, Jarrett, that really forms us. It formed him in his family, Steve's family. Then later in life, when he was ready for his career in business, he surrounded himself with the right people to be successful in business, Jarrett.
Yeah, and having that plan, again, the education, coming back to that, facing adversity. And so many times, you know, we've spoken to parents, and we advise them, and we talk to them about you do need to let your children face adversity. We can't protect them from everything, and we need to let them fail. There needs to be an element of failure, but being there as parents to say, now this is how we bounce back. And here we hear that from Steve's story, you know, being able to be resilient. We talk about that so much, and here we are having another story of a life of resiliency.
Absolutely, and I know Jarrett was thinking about a question on that, so I'll jump right into a question that my new mentor, another business mentor, Chrissy Carew, Coach Carew, really has been able to help me in my business since I've known her, to really develop more focus in what I'm trying to do. What does it mean, Steve, for you to be an insightful player? It's fantastic that we're finally highlighting players' careers off the field and what they do to help others in so many ways to work with children. What does it mean for you to be an insightful player, Steve?
It's pretty special. I mean, I've always tried to, as my parents taught me, to stay involved in the community. I'm involved with Easter Seals in Massachusetts, done things for the local YMCA, Wrentham State School for the mentally handicapped. It just goes on and on. It's important to give back to the community when you've had a chance to be successful at whatever it is you do. It's almost, to me, it's almost the most important thing is to give something back to the people around you, and I've always tried to do that, and to be an insightful player. Chrissy asked me to be one of them, talk to her for her book. I can tell she's doing this thing all for the right reasons, and that's why I'm happy to be a part of it.
Absolutely. And Steve, if you got a chance to, I'll have to sometimes forward you some of those podcast interviews with the other insightful players. What we're seeing from the younger players in the generation of, I guess, the 2000s, unbelievable people that Chrissy has chosen to be insightful players. They truly know about giving back. They know about that giving portion of things, Jarrett. And you can share about that for a second, Jarrett, really quickly. The Insightful Player Series in the way where what makes it different from the other athletes we've interviewed, Jarrett, or celebrities and stuff?
It's such an easy answer. It's an all-star team of men who are, again, providing experience and teaching and coaching and mentoring, but it's an all-star team of community leaders and community service-oriented people. That's the way I look at the Insightful Players.
That's a great point. And, okay, Steve, where can we find information on you and learn more about you so that we can check out your business and, I guess, other things that are going on with Steve?
Well, I don't go around publishing what's going on with me very often, so you might be able to look something up on the internet. We have a website for the business. It's groganmarciano.com. Right now our website's under construction, so you may not get much information there, but should be up and running here before too long. Other than that, I'm just living my life, trying to do the right thing, the best that I can every day, and if people hear about it, great. If they don't, it's not a big deal.
So you're kind of in the shadows now after the career, and it kind of shows your career and in life. You chose to be in business now, and you're still out there helping in the community, but ultimately you want to be in the background. And that shows great humility, and it shows, especially an unbelievable career that you've had, that ultimately the spotlight's not what you're looking for at this time in your career. You're looking at how I can give back, how I can help others, and how I can transform society. So I really commend you about that, Steve. That's fantastic.
Well, I've never forgotten that the success I've had was due in part to a lot of people, whether it was my parents or my teammates, and now in business, people that work for me. I wouldn't be successful without a lot of other people doing their jobs and setting a good example. So I'm just trying to do the same thing for others.
All right, Steve. Well, I appreciate you coming by. I'd love to have you back at a time to catch up on the career, more about football and life as well. And best of luck to you and your business. And I'm not going to say go Pats, but I'm going to say definitely go Steve Grogan. And I'm an even bigger fan after getting to talk to you. So thanks for coming
by. Well, I appreciate it. Thank you so much. Enjoyed visiting with you guys.
All right, take care, Steve. See ya. Okay, bye-bye. You're listening to the Total Tuner Show, powered by the Insightful Player Series, and we'll be back in just a moment.
We're back to Neil Haley's show on the Total Celebrity segment. I can't believe I just said that, but I know this man is becoming a celebrity in his own right. Caregiver Dave. Dave, thanks for calling. How are you? And it's a celebrity because of just who you've been with since the last time I had you on the program and all the exciting things you're doing on a regular basis. Dave, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Hey, always fantastic. Doing always super. And I wanted to kind of find out what's going on with Dave. What is new with Dave? Especially I have you on my radio program co-hosting with me. But I never, ever get
I know. You never talk about
enough.
Me. And it seems like forever that I was interviewed on your show, and I think it was forever. But so much has happened. I mean, I just I'm amazed. You know, there's a word called momentum, and what is it when you reach that critical mass where you got this train going down
exactly.
the tracks and nothing can stop it. But you know that train when it was stopped, it's like nothing could move it. You know, I have a gas station, and I'm at the bottom of this hill, and everybody misses that sign at the top of the hill that says, get gas at the top, there's 27 miles and nothing down below. And nobody sees that, and they run out of gas, and they coast in on fumes. And at least once a day, we got to get a push crew to push this car, you know, across the street, into our driveway, approach the lanes, and it's hard.
Exactly.
You know, you need about four people. Just put your back into it. And we get that car rolling and it gets a little faster. And then the driveway starts sloping down, and now we have some momentum. Now we can't stop it. Oh, put on the brake. And that's how it is. 18 months ago, I was just a normal guy, you know, just running my gas station.
Yeah,
and all
exactly.
of a sudden,
we told you, Yeah. And
I meet this guy who changes my life, and he got me on Harvard, got me on 24 morning shows. Actually, he taught me how to get myself to book myself on these shows. And then I did Harvard again. I did NASDAQ. We got our picture on the Jumbotron in Times Square. I'm speaking at Coca-Cola, Mercedes-Benz, going to talk to our nation's future leaders at the West Point Military Academy. I just got invited to do a TEDx talk this month in Wilmington, Delaware, at a women's conference. And I just got a phone call 2 days ago. You don't even know about this one, where they want to I spoke in Hawaii. I go to Hawaii twice a year for vacation, 4 weeks each,
right, exactly.
Just because we love it. And, you know, we're spending our children's inheritance because they don't call anyway. And tomorrow is not promised, Neil. My wife is 74 years old. She's in a wheelchair. She's disabled.
Right.
She lost her speech from a stroke. But she's amazing. She puts us all to shame because she can do things that I can't do. And so at 52, she had her stroke, and I'm 64, and I'm saying, you know what, we can still travel. I'm not going to be that guy who says, gosh, I wish we would have traveled more when we were younger, you know. And so I got a call from Hawaii last August. I was on a panel. I spoke at 7 venues over there, and they called me back, and they says, you know, we want you to be the headliner this time at the next one. We want you to be the keynote speaker. I says, great, I can do it. I never say no to opportunity. We'll work out the details later. So I'm just excited.
No, I mean, and I think what you really learned is, and again, you definitely owe a lot to Clint for what you've done, but ultimately not everyone that goes through Clint's program has the success you have.
You got to do the work, okay? So I'm just stupid enough to know that if I'm going to, you know, invest in myself, then you got to do the work. How many of us have gone to a seminar and we come back with everything that this guy supposedly knows? We got the binders, we got the books, we got the CDs, and then we put it up on our shelf, and it's been there for 5 years now. We didn't do anything because we were overwhelmed. But this guy doesn't let you be overwhelmed. He forces you to do it. It's
he forces you to do it, but see,
he forces you.
The same, but also talent. You cannot say that it wasn't your talent as well and your niche opportunity, because there are many people out there that go through programs even like Clint and don't have the success that you have. And I know for a fact that's the case. So don't put. It's great that he gave you the roadmap.
Well, I wanted it.
Take that road.
I wanted it. You got to ask yourself, how bad do you want it? You know, do you want it so bad that you can taste it? And you know, I've wasted so much money over the years going to seminars and going to this, you name it, I've done it. But after a while, you just get tired of spending your money on stuff. You become very skeptical about all the promises people make. You know, you find out that people are just lying. You know, they call it exaggeration or stretching the truth. Let's call it what it is. They're lying. And finally, I meet a guy who doesn't lie. In fact, he guarantees, if you can't get booked on 3 television programs after you come to my boot camp, I will give all of your money back and $1,000 on top of it. So I said, well, what do I got to lose? And the guy changed my life. I changed my life. God changed my life. Let's give credit where credit is due.
Exactly. Let's give credit to God. Let's give credit to specifically enough this holiday season and how lucky we are to be on this earth and to try to make a difference and change people's lives. But what I think that what you have done in this process is that you've said, I have the ability. I now go after it, and I learned what other people do that is not the way you should do things. And so you learned all that, and that's fantastic. So,
and timing is very, very important, because if this happened before it happened, it wouldn't have happened, because, number one, my back was shot. I needed back surgery. I couldn't stand for more than 5 minutes. There was no way I could be on a book tour or chasing, you know, buses and subways and airplane terminals. I could not do that. So, number one, God healed my back. Thank God. Didn't need surgery. Number two, you need your wife's support. If she's not behind you and egging you on and being your cheerleader, then forget it. You know, it'll just... you'll be sabotaged. Number three, I have a gas station, okay? I got employees. It's a 24-hour business. When someone doesn't come in, guess who's got the burden of working? But now I've got a good crew. I've got partners, and they're great partners, and we help each other out. So I've got help at the station. And the third thing is, you know, thank God I've got the money to spend on myself, right? And other people have money. You hear about these people who die, you know, 80 years old, and they were living like paupers. They're living in a little one-bedroom apartment or whatever it is, and their kids are doing their thing, and they realize that these people were millionaires. And what were they saving the money for? Well, they were saving it for a rainy day. Well, you know what? Start spending that money, because when you get older and when you die, you go to heaven, you're not going to say, you know, gee, I wish I would have paid some more bills, or gee, I wish I would have, you know, worked more. No, you would have said, I wish I would have traveled more. I wish I would have spent more time with my family. I wish I would have spent the money that I had so I didn't leave these millions to my kids, and it ended up screwing them up because they didn't work for it. They don't know the value of a dollar. That's my opinion.
To really know you are the man, but what would you say are your greatest experiences? You talk about speaking. I've heard you speak about.
What's the question? My greatest experience, what?
The experience speaking.
Well, Harvard, I think I was very fortunate to be able to speak there first, because once you do that, the most prestigious place on earth that you could probably speak, there ain't too much that's going to upset you afterwards. And, you know, you start at the top, and we also went through a speaker training that he had in Hawaii, and we went down into this boat, and they stuck us in a cage. And we were told to speak to the sharks. The cage went down underwater, and they started throwing raw meat over the side of the boat. And I tell you, there were hundreds of sharks, like 5 inches from my face. And the cage, you know, they're about 6 inches, 7 inches apart. So it's like if they just turn their head sideways, you know, they'd get their teeth in there. But he wanted us to practice our speeches, so I did, you know. And I said, but water will get in my mouth. He said, no, it won't. You got a snorkel in your mouth. So I tell you, when you speak at Harvard, when you speak to the sharks, there isn't anything that freaks you out. And the night before I spoke at Harvard, I was getting freaked out. I was saying, oh, my God, what did I get myself into? I can't, I was forgetting my lines. I was over-rehearsing, and then I just remembered that God brought me there. Trust in God, trust in the process, trust in Clint. I did my homework. I did my rehearsing. I went to bed with a peaceful spirit. I slept like a baby, woke up in the morning, gave my speech, knocked it out of the park. And so whenever I get nervous, I just remind myself, what are you nervous about? You spoke at Harvard. You spoke to the sharks. And so I would say that would be the best. Sharing the stage with Suzanne Somers, oh, my gosh, the woman is amazing. And we were able to field questions from the audience. Do you have a question for Suzanne Somers, you know, and so on. So I just feel like I've done it all, and this all happened in 16 months.
Ice training, I can't believe it. Ice fishing. Did you know how bad of an ice storm we had last night? Let me tell you the story, Dave, and I don't know if I'll put this on this or not. Yeah, we're going to have our own comedy hour tonight. Basically, the phones must be going batty, and I've never ever seen the towers. Can the towers, you've been around, do you know if cell phone towers can mess up like this?
Right.
That's for my other time in that area, but you know I'll edit it and make it perfect for you, Dave, as I always do. We've had some interesting interviews ourselves, haven't we? Are we doing the caregiver, Dave, Neil, Haley? Some of these celebrities you've interviewed, they've been interesting, right? You never know what they're going to say.
Absolutely. I meet some great people since I met you now. So, you know, they say surround yourself with the 5 people that you want to be like. And so that means you're going to have to get rid of some friends, because you will become those people. So are you surrounding yourself with losers, with people that you went to high school with who are still doing drugs, who are still, you know, working at Walmart? Nothing against Walmart. But you want to surround yourself with people who are smarter than you, richer than you, brighter than you, more intelligent than you. And guess what? It rubs off. And I'm so grateful to have met you, Neil. And I'm thankful for all the great guests. I mean, I met the Brady. Who's the oldest Brady son?
You remember him messing up that name? Oh my gosh!
The name just escaped my head. Hal, right?
It happens all the time. Greg Brady.
It's amazing that I speak at Harvard with my memory. It's amazing. It's a miracle that I can pull this off.
When I look at the different interviews and the different experiences of
Greg Brady, that's who it is. Okay.
Greg Brady, exactly. But you think of just different people from NFL players to other celebrities, the Bonaducci girl.
Melissa Radke, 150 million views on YouTube, a publisher sees her, you need to write a book. Okay. All of a sudden, she gets an offer for a reality show. She's taping her 9th reality episode right now. Oh, my gosh. You know, you talk about overnight success. But, you know, we've been struggling for 10, 15, 20 years. Yeah, it's a 20-year overnight success.
The country music stars as well, Dave.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Jenna Jay, Hee Haw.
Yeah. Yeah. And then
I don't know how you get these people, Neil,
right,
but you've got the magic touch. They call you, right?
They call me. Exactly.
It's amazing.
That's one of the cool.
And I'm just along for the ride.
Exactly, Dave. We're working on Nancy Grace right now, probably after Thanksgiving with her. And then other country music stars are coming out of the woodwork. But you got to interview some unbelievable ones you wouldn't have thought of as in the country music game, too, that you grew up listening to.
We're making some nice networks here. I'm friends with a doctor who works at the White House who does electronic stimulation of the brain. It's like an acupuncture, and he's looking for football players who have suffered traumatic brain injury. Well, you've got all the football players. I've got the
board in your career. It's a great question asked. You spoke all these places. You've had all these great experiences. What is next? Because let's just talk about delving into caregiving. This is something that just really is just such a horrific thing when somebody loses someone through dementia or they're not able to handle specific things. This is your mission. Where are you going next? You built the brand. Now everyone respects you, understands you, knows you. Now you have to help these people.
Celebrityism comes with a mission, with a purpose. You know, I was born for this, apparently. 22 years ago, I was just a normal guy. My wife complains about a headache she had. Well, the headache turned into a stroke. She lost her speech, became paralyzed on the right side. For a couple of years, man, it was hell on earth. Because that's called the grief process, and anger was her favorite emotion, and I was getting all of it. And I almost left. That's how bad it was, because I couldn't take it. But I hung in there. You know, I had my faith in God. Something like that either makes you bitter or better. You know, it's easy to ask somebody how strong their faith in God is when they got money in the bank, when their beautiful wife is loving them, when, you know, their CPA is saying, wow, you had a great year. But talk to me when the CPA tells you that bankruptcy is the only way out, that your wife serves you divorce papers, that the doctor tells you got 3 weeks to live, and so on. Now you'll see what you're made of. That's the kind of faith that's ever. So I realized that my faith was real because it brought me through it. 22 years later, you know, it's just the new normal. We're getting along great. We're in love with each other like we've never been. We travel all over the country. I speak everywhere.
Tremendous.
Telling caregivers how to prevent your loved one's illness or disease from killing you. Now I'm speaking at TED Talks this month. And TED Talks is a little different. I can't promote myself. I can't tell them I have a book. I can't tell them I've spoken at Harvard.
Yeah.
I can't say anything about myself, which is hard because that's half my speech.
so
we cut all that out, and I'm learning a lot. I'm really out of my comfort zone, and I'm so grateful that my wife is along for the ride and that we're doing what we're doing, and we're helping people. So the talk, this one is called Caregivers Need to Be Selfish in Order to Survive. And it's an idea worth spreading. And because selfish is usually a very negative word, right? Nobody wants to be selfish. Selfish means you're self-absorbed and all you care about is yourself. But you know what? Caregivers are so opposite of the word selfish that they're dying. You know, they give and give and give, and there's nothing left to give, and they don't eat right, they don't sleep right, they don't exercise, they've isolated themselves, they got no friends, and 30% of them actually die before their loved ones do, and those are the lucky ones. 60% of them actually get sicker, become hospitalized, and need a caregiver of their own. And roughly half of all these caregivers are feeling suicidal depression and hopelessness, you know, just like Robin Williams, Kate Spade, Anthony Bourdain, you know,
right.
They all died of the same thing, suicidal depression. So we have to ask, if there's depression, is suicide far behind? And that's my mission, to save caregiver lives. And so I have a website. I'm Dave the Caregiver's Caregiver. And the short domain is caregiverdave.com. And you go there. I turned it into a membership website because you probably realize this too. When people don't pay, they don't value the advice you give. I would coach for years and years, and I didn't charge a nickel. And sometimes, many times, they don't even show up for the call. It's like they're not valuing the wisdom that I'm giving them. And, you know, let's think about it. If you have a doctor appointment at, like, 8 o'clock in the morning and you get to bed late and the alarm goes off at 7, and you just say, oh, I can't go, I'm too tired. But you know what? If that doctor's charging you $100 whether you show up or not, you're going to be there. So I'm not doing anybody a favor by not charging them for coaching. I have coaching programs to help caregivers stay alive, to help them stay out of the hospital. I have a membership website. And I'm not trying to rip people off. I don't even need the money. But I'm not doing caregivers a favor. If I cannot get a caregiver to pay $97 to invest in themselves, to become healthy and to stay alive, becoming a lifetime member of my membership website, caregiverdave.com, then I can't help them, because they need to have some value of themselves, that their life is at least as valuable as the ones they're caring for, that they're not on the bottom rung. They need to be on the top rung. Put your oxygen mask on first. Otherwise, you're both going down, buddy.
Now, thinking, see, these are great points that you're making, but let's talk about preparing for TEDx. Now, what are you going to do? You only give us a snippet, because once it's live and it's out there, we'll be talking about it in another interview. But tell us specifically what your topic is for TEDx.
TEDx, like I said, it's caregivers need to be selfish in order to survive. So I will go, and I'll basically share those statistics about the 30% dying, the 60% getting sicker, and the 50%, you know, having suicidal depression. It doesn't look pretty for them. So I basically, the talk goes on, and I keep mentioning over and over again, caregivers need to be selfish in order to survive. I say that 5 times throughout this 10-minute talk, and that is supposed to get through to them. Okay, well, selfish isn't really a dirty word now if you're a caregiver, because if it is, if you think that, oh, no, I can't be selfish. I was going to name my book. You know, I have a book that's called It's My Life to Reclaim Your Caregiver's Sanity by Learning When to Say Yes and When to Say No. I was going to call it the Selfish Caregiver. And my publisher, everybody says, no, 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 you can't do that. That's a negative thing. Nobody will buy that book. Nobody wants to be selfish. So I listen to them. But now it's coming back. When I told the people at TEDx about the selfish thing, they loved it. And I said, wow, that's a change.
So, you know, it's interesting when you talk about that. And are there anyone else that's ever done a TEDx talk about caregiving? That's the question that you need to research on. Has anyone ever done a TEDx talk about it?
I really don't know. I don't know. That's a good thing to look up. But a lot of people don't talk about caregiving. I mean, we talk about dementia, we talk about Alzheimer's, we talk about cancer, all these famous and sexy diseases that, you know, there's organizations for. There's the Alzheimer's Association, there's the Cancer Society, you know, there's the Heart Association, all these things that get lots of money. People donate lots of money because they want to find out what's causing dementia, what's causing, you know, stroke and so on. But nobody is saying anything about caregivers. Do you know that there are 65.7 million caregivers in the U.S., and those are just the ones that we know about? There's so many caregivers out there who don't even know they're caregivers, because think about it. Okay, you got a neighbor, he's elderly, you see him every day, you know, walking out, struggling to bend over to pick up the newspaper. So you say, well, I'm going to be a nice guy. I'm going to go over there, take his paper in for him. Oh, thanks. Hey, while you're in here, you know, I'm trying to reach this shelf on the top, bowl on the top shelf. So you say, oh, yeah, I'll get that. Next thing you know, you're making the guy breakfast. Next thing you know, you're taking him to his doctor appointments. Next thing you know, you're his caregiver, and you say, oh, my God, how did I get sucked into this? You know, there are children from 8 years old to 18 years old, children caring for adult loved ones, grandparents,
parents.
Labor laws don't apply to them. They're not getting their 30-minute lunch break. They're not getting their 20-minute breaks every 4 hours. It's really bad, and no one is talking about it. I call it the caregiver tsunami, because just like Medicare and Social Security, right, more people are taking out of the system now than putting in. It wasn't like during the war when it was the opposite. Well, guess what? All the baby boomers are getting dementia, Alzheimer's, COPD,
exactly.
Falling down, breaking their hips. Everyone's got parents and grandparents who are needing a caregiver, and there aren't enough of them, because the baby boomers are one of the biggest people groups. The next largest people group are the millennials, I understand, because during the 80s, you know, everybody was successful and starting businesses and having babies. And right now, that's called the sandwich generation. When those millennials have to take care of their children and they have to take care of their parents. And in my case, I have like a club sandwich, because that's add your spouse to that, and you got a triple-decker club sandwich, you know? And it's no one's talking about it, and it's only going to get worse. It's not going to get better. We need to do something. It needs to be part of the health care plan that the president or the Congress or whoever is going to come up with one. There needs to be caregiver respite. Now, I came from Hawaii. They have the only law in the nation that gives caregivers money, $1,500 a month if you qualify. And how do you qualify? Well, not like down here where you got to be broke and you got to have no job and you got to be destitute. No, you can have a 40-hour-a-week job and you'll still get the money, because they know that it takes money if you are a caregiver in addition to your job. So I think that's a model for the nation, and I tell everybody about it wherever I go.
All right, well, fabulous. Again, caregiverdave.com. You got your radio show. They can check out at caregiverdave.com. They can become
got
a
the
member.
Membership website.
And everything. And next week,
coaching
we continue
program.
To rock into Thanksgiving.
One-stop shopping.
Everyone,
it's all there.
Everyone's going to be out. Be ready. Thanksgiving week every time. Everyone wants to do an interview right before Thanksgiving. So good.
And if anybody wants to know how I'm getting on TV, how I'm getting on Harvard, how am I getting on NASDAQ, Coca-Cola, West Point, email me. I'm at dave@nassani.tv. That's N like Nancy, A-S-S like Sam, A-N like Nancy, E-Y. dave@nassani.tv. And if you want to find me on the Internet, just Google Caregiver Dave, and I'll be there. Like Michael Jackson, I'll be there.
That's fantastic, Dave. Good talking to you, brother, and we'll talk soon, man.
Thanks, Neil.
All right. Okay, bye-bye. You listen to Neil Haley's show. We'll be back in just a moment.
Oh, good morning. I'm so excited to welcome the program. And from Cinemax's The Nick, SFX makeup artist, Justin Raleigh. Justin, thanks for calling. And I was just doing some research about this show, and it seems pretty fascinating for sure. It definitely a historical background and kind of gory in ways too, right?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It's very historically accurate. It's, you know, turn of the century, beginning of modern medicine, basically.
Yeah, can you tell me a little bit about what SFX means in makeup artist? What does that mean? Yeah.
So special makeup effects artist is someone that deals with creature effects, or you need to make someone look old, or, you know, they've gained weight, character makeup design. We even do, like, specialty costume. Specifically for the Nick, though, it's all forensic medical recreation. So surgical bodies, you know, prosthetics, medical anomalies, things like that.
You've been on a lot of big shows. Once you were asked to do the Nick, were you really interested right from the beginning after reading the script and seeing what types of things you were going to be doing?
Yeah, I had worked with one of the producers before, Michael Pallaire, and he sent me the first, I think, five episodes of season one. And I read through them within a day. I mean, it was just such great material that there's no way that I could turn it down. I called them back immediately and said, yeah, where do you need me? New York? 5 months? Great. I'm there.
And what is that? What does that entail? How much do you get to know the show being that makeup artist? How much, like, because again, we always hear about the producer, the director, the actors, but we forget about the makeup artist sometimes, and that what's entailed and how much you are as part of that team.
Yeah, it all depends on the show. I mean, with something like this, the medical effects are such a high profile part of the show that, you know, if they didn't really work, I think the show would have a little bit of trouble as well. At least that's what Steven Soderbergh had told us. So there's a lot of demand put on us. We went in right from the beginning, had all 10 episodes in front of us, broke it down, and then started designing the entire thing like a 10-hour movie.
Oh, wow.
So we were heavily involved from day one, well before even some of the actors had been hired, just because they knew the stuff had to work, it had to look good, because it is a focal point. You know, it's a very graphic show, and
right.
And Stephen was definitely wanting to focus on those effects.
You want to know the storyline. Is that correct? So you need to know the storyline. You need to know who the characters are, all those things, as being the makeup artist, because you're creating these looks. You're creating what making the script come to life in that way, especially if you're when you were working with Independence Day or any of or Star Trek or anything that you work with. That's the thing. The characters need to come to life when you make them so authentic, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we, you know, day one, the first thing we start with is we take the script, we break it down, we figure out all the action that's entailed. We next sit down with the director, kind of talk through their thoughts of how they want to shoot it, what they expect from these effects. And then we start building and catering exactly to their needs at that point.
So tell us a little bit about the show for people who have not seen the show. And again, the second season is now available on DVD, all different places available, Blu-ray, the second season. But tell us a little bit about the show.
Yeah, so it's beginning 1900s, turn of the century. This is medical-based. So you have Dr. Thackeray, which is Clive Owen's character, basically genius surgeon. He's breaking ground with new ideas and new ways to approach surgery. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, sadly. And on the backside of that, he is completely addicted to cocaine.
Oh, wow.
So, which is really based on a real surgeon. I mean, there was a lot of surgeons at the time that had issues like this. They were incredible, genius doctors and changing the world, but they also had drug addiction, because at that time they really didn't understand drug addiction. So they were just using it as a means to keep going, if you will. So
I mean, so this seems very fascinating. So first of all, you're seeing that this guy is experimenting with all these different people's lives, and yet he had a drug addiction. So that really causes some problems.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. There's a bit of a God complex there. Definitely some ego going on. But at that time there wasn't any other way to experiment, or practice medicine. You know, the old model of medicine was you see one, you do one, you teach one. So, and that's very much the model in the show as well. You see one, do one, teach one.
So that's interesting to me, because then you don't think 1900s, that wasn't so long ago, and yet people had to allow doctors to do whatever they could for the people to survive, because they didn't know what would work and what wouldn't work in so many ways. And now we have ways of, I guess, working with lab rats and different other animals, or trying with cadavers, yet at that time they didn't figure this out, it sounds like.
No, I mean, they used to work on a lot of pigs and other animals to test theories, and a bit of it became experimentation on the actual operating table as well, experimenting with different drugs, different ways to put people under before they went into surgery. The show really covers a lot of a lot of those elements. You know, one of the big ones in season one was what's called placenta previa, which is the beginning of the C-section.
Oh, my.
And amazingly, the development, you know, we sit down and we work with a historian, a medical historian named Dr. Burns, who comes in. He's a New York local that has a medical archive, the Burns Archives. And, you know, he brought us incredible amounts of